If you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Kyle Mason on the show. Kyle, how are you doing?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. Tonight I wanted to talk about a posting you put on your blog there, the Four Horses Asses of the Apocalypse, that's your blog. Four Horses blog, what's all that about?
Well, it kind of came out of, Hoaxbusters call, you know, Chris, and I know you know John. Well, through John's punk rock research, he started off, Nino joined up, and then I kind of joined in later, and we started talking punk rock stuff, and along with Rich, and we kind of decided to put a blog together to just throw our research up on as we come across it, and kind of started a group. You know, I hear you and Joe Atwill often talking about just meeting up and getting groups together, and I kind of think that's what we did.
Oh, I see. So, yeah, I see. So you got together, do the research, sort of a collective yep. effort. And I know.
Yeah, mostly focused on punk rock and different you know, social engineering, and it started with punk rock and branch out to other things, all media manipulation and social engineering type things.
Yeah, I interviewed John Adams about his research on punk rock. I think he actually was contributed some research to Dave McGowan when he was still around. He emailed him some information for it, if I got that right.
Yeah.
And I know Dave McGowan relied on a lot of that for his research and where to go on things. He never got into the punk rock scene, but I know that you all kind of you examined punk rock in the same way that Dave McGowan examined the Laurel Canyon scene of the 1960s, how this, like the Laurel Canyon scene, the punk rock scene was engineered by the intelligence agencies. It was more or less an intelligence operation. And you all make the same similar connections, you know, with some of these punk rock figures to families that have ties to banking, intelligence, military, along that theme, correct?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. He's a big influence, McGowan is.
Mm-hmm. Now tonight, I ran into this piece. I heard it mentioned on the Hoaxbusters call, so I decided to read it regarding. What got my attention was this reporter, Jim Miller,
It's actually John Miller.
Oh, sorry, John Miller.
To interrupt you.
Yeah, John Miller, and his interview with he was able to interview Osama bin Laden in 1998, and this you drew the, some connection between him and because he married into this family, the Altshul family, this very wealthy elite financing banking family, and you did this whole blog posting on a more or less a century of this family's involvement in propaganda. Finance, banking, geopolitics. The Altshul family, how do you want to first dive into this?
Well, you know, you brought up the conclusion there with John Miller, and mm-hmm. I was a freshman in high school then in 1998, and I saw that production there, that those theatrics on ABC with Jim Miller interviewing Osama bin Laden, and you know, I saw him hiking up the mountain and then him sitting with this Arab man saying that he's declaring war on America. You know, this was unprecedented to me. I'd never seen anything like this. And they're kind of associating him with prior, minor, somewhat, at least compared to 9/11, minor terrorism against the United States. And I couldn't wrap my mind around how a reporter, could get in, have this kind of access to go talk to someone who's America's most wanted, basically. And by the time I was a senior in high school, 2001, I kind of realized, I had been predictively programmed. I didn't know the term for it then. But I kind of put two and two together, and I said, this didn't make sense, that there's got to be something fishy went on there for sure, because he wanted me to know about Osama bin Laden, because I remember that, before they were even saying bin Laden on the news, I had already thought, that was that guy I saw. It must have been him. Yeah, I feel like I got some answers through this that, had been with me for a while. But where I wanted to start is, I found the Lehman family directory for their inter-family communications from 1995. Found it on the archives on the internet. Get a drink of water here. So I'm going to just run off a list of people that I found that had connections to the media. They've got a lot more connections into banking, but they're all in this Lehman family directory. So they're on the family tree that's included in the post and has links to all this information. And let me just say, yeah, all the information in the post is pretty much copy and pasted from mainstream sources. I didn't hardly write anything myself. And I would say other than the stuff I got from Jan Ervin, which is a small section, it's all mainstream. So, okay, let's start with Nicholas M. Loeb. He's the son of John Langloth Loeb Jr., a scion of both the Loeb family and Lehman family. So the Loeb family is connected to the Federal Reserve major. His father was a former United States ambassador to Denmark and served as a delegate to the United Nations. In 1996, his mother was killed by her third husband, Jeff Bauer, and then killed herself. Oh, sorry. His mother killed her third husband. After college, he worked for Mike Nichols on the film Primary Colors at his uncle's Universal Studios. So then he was engaged to the Modern Family star Sofia Vergara, which is ABC propaganda of what the modern American family should be. There's a gay family on there. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, yeah, it has its moments, but yeah, it's completely dysfunctional family, completely, typical fare. Yeah.
Yeah. So he ended up fighting her for embryos that they had frozen together when their engagement broke off.
That is a modern dilemma, isn't it?
Quite.
Postmodern dilemma.
Yes, exactly. So then we've got Edgar Bronfman Sr. In 1996, Semp Investments, which managed the family's investments, bought 820,000 shares of MGM.
Is that the Bronfman family?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay.
So they bought 820,000 shares of MGM, and in 1969, Bronfman took over the chairmanship of MGM. His son, Samuel Bronfman, was abducted, and they paid a $2.3 million ransom to get him back, and they got the money back along with the FBI. We got Paul Arthur Buttenweiser, psychiatrist and author of Their Pride and Joy and Free Association from Harvard Medical School and Harvard College. We got Helen Rebecca Goodhart Billings, editor for William Morrow and Company, researcher and producer. We've got B. Burge, editor of the Living Pulpit Journal for Preaching, financial analyst and negotiations of government contracts for U.S. government from 1942 to 1947, Yale University. June Rosbach Bingham Burge, author and playwright, 4 books, 4 plays, articles for the New York Times, op-ed page, Washington Post, Red Book, Mademoiselle, American Heritage. She went to Vassar. Andrew Blackman, journalist for the BBC, London School of Economics. Susan Catherine Buttenweiser, editorial staff of Miss Magazine. So that's a major red flag there. Mm-hmm. Sarah Worthen Buttenweiser, writer for the New York Times. Lucinda Franks, former staff writer for the New York Times, writer for New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic. She won the Pulitzer Prize for a thing she wrote about the weathermen. And she's the youngest person to win the prize. Jane Mayer Field, editor of Time Life Books, managing editor of Consumer Reports, executive editor of The Nation, Parents Magazine, American Jewish Committee, 1941 to 1943. Oh, I'm sorry. That's Harold C. Field, the husband of Jane Mayer Field. So Sarah Frank Rosbach Fleming, writer of the books Interior Design with Feng Shui in 1987 and Feng Shui, the Chinese Arts of Placement in 1983. Isabel Schumann Friedman, U.S. representative of French publishers of illustrated books, senior editor for editions Flammarion. Benjamin Herbert Goodhart, press officer, Channel 4 TV. Richard N. Beatty and Karen Beatty, they are $3 million donors to the Church of Scientology, which makes them platinum meritorious with honors. And there's a picture of them posing with a Scientology trophy. Got Arthur Wynant Goodhart. He's a literary agent. Cynthia Nevins Mayer, reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer, reporter for the St. Petersburg Times, assistant editor for the American Lawyer. Sharon McCluskey Sandys, her husband is the Earl Sandys, contributing editor for Andy Warhol Interview, writer for New York Daily Column, articles in Town and Country. Henry Morgenthau III, from 1945, he was involved in the television business at various times, working as an author, producer, and manager for the larger national institutions like NBC, CBS, and ABC. From 1955 to 1977, Morgenthau was a chief producer for WGBH in Boston. His shows at WGBH won Peabody, Emmy, UPI, Educational Film Library Association, and Flaherty Film Festival Awards. Kramer Morgenthau, American cinematographer work in films such as Thor, Terminator, Genesis, Game of Thrones, Sleepy Hollow, and Boardwalk Empire. Suzanne Cambria-Lowe, documentary and educational TV film production. Douglas Everidge Mayer, producer of Weatherwise, which I think is a magazine, and radio management. Andrew Shoup Mayer, author and partner in book packaging design, author of a bunch of books here, including The Official Book of Thumb Wrestling. Maureen McCluskey Oxenberg, stockbroker, public relations, actress, casting agent. Luciano Rastelli, he worked for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. So does Lucy Latane Gordon Rastelli, who's also a journalist and works for the UN with the Food Agriculture Organization. And Stephen Frank Alchel, who I'll get into more later, was also a teacher at the St. Stephen School in Rome, which the St. Stephen School in Rome specializes, according to Wikipedia, in teaching children of parents from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Cynthia Rosbach Stebbins, Ford Models, new model director, freelance fashion stylist, and Harper's Bazaar. And I'm sorry if that was really long and boring, but I think that kind of sets the stage of non-Alchel members of the Lehman family who obviously have major media connections and banking connections, and some of them have aristocratic titles. And
well, yeah, I mean, you get the banking finance connection to media, whether it's movies, TVs, the news, things like Consumer Reports, right? All right, or did you say Consumer? Not Consumer Reports. Did you say Consumer Reports?
I don't think so, but yeah, I'd imagine that would have to be completely controlled.
Publications, television shows, entertainment, fashion, these things, this is all part of sort of, control of culture and information in society. And obviously a wealthy banking family, an oligarchical family, is going to leverage its wealth to control those areas for the purposes of, securing and increasing its wealth and control and power. Your piece, you open up in your piece, Alchel, 100 Years of Propaganda and Monetary Dominance. You have a quote by J. Herbert Alchel in his book Agents of Power, The Role of News Media in Human Affairs. And the quote is, "The history of the press demonstrates that newspapers and the more modern variations of the press have tended to serve the selfish interests of the paymasters, while at the same time perpetuating the image of a press operating in the service of the consumers of the news. To expect that the news media will make a dramatic U-turn and scoff at the wishes of the paymasters is to engage in the wildest kind of utopian fantasies." So,
yeah, and he's not related, to, at least as far as I could find, to this Alchel family.
All right, that's right. Name is it's Alt-Skull. That's right.
Maybe. Yeah, there's an extra L there.
I see. Yeah. Okay. I see. Okay. Interesting. I think it's a pretty it's an accurate description of the situation, I think, and at least from my estimations.
And absolutely.
Your article goes on to make the case for that situation.
Yeah, and I start with Charles Alchel. With Charles Alchel, he's the father of Frank Alchel, who some people may be familiar with. And he started at Lazard Frères. He was the eighth employee there. He became manager of the London, Paris, and American Bank in 1895. He was elected president of the American Bankers Research Association in 1900. He resigned from those to become a partner in Lazard Frères in New York. When he retired in 1916, it appears that's when he started his propaganda work with the government.
This would have been the run-up to the First World War, America's, at least America's entry into the war.
Yes, exactly. And it seems like the U.S. government needed to kind of change public opinion towards Britain in a more positive light, and I guess towards Germany in a more negative light. And yeah, they used Charles Eichel to do that.
And he was working for the Committee on Public Information, the otherwise known as the Creel Committee, which employed, I believe, people like Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann, I think, if I have that correct?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And I guess his job here is to change public opinion by providing them public information. How nice of them. So I guess it was objective information they were serving up to the public. It was biased a little bit, I guess you could say.
Yeah. And the way he did it, in 1917, so 100 years ago, he did it by changing the history, changing the past. He wrote a book called The American Revolution in our school textbooks, and was postulating that it was in too negative of a light on England, and how we had to change that in the school textbooks for children. So what they're going to teach them about the history is somehow easily just changed.
Well, it's interesting. This also coincides with in the latter half of the 19th century is this the rapprochement between United States and Great Britain, largely at the instigation of the Rhodes Circle. And this was the attempt to sort of reincorporate the United States into the Anglo fold by embarking on a broad cultural political agenda, doing this very thing. Of course, World War I accelerated because Britain knew it had to draw the United States into the war for them to achieve their objective in World War I, defeating Germany. So we have here, I think, during this time, the Pilgrim Society, Union Now movement. This is Hollywood's early Hollywood played a much bigger role in the Second World War. But yeah, you get this. I think that through the Pilgrim Society, they're the ones that was it the Pilgrim Society that revitalized Mount Vernon and started promoting the whole sort of colonial history. Because that would obviously bring up bring to mind the British influence of America and the sort of this British cultural conquest of the United States, which continued throughout the 20th century up in, at least continues today with this worshiping of the British royal family here in the States. Kind of attention gets in the media, but particularly with the British invasion, the music of the 1960s, you can see another phase of that going on. And some people have made the connection between the Rolling Stones, London School of Economics, Beatles to Tavistock and these things. So that's interesting that this goes, that he's involved in this in the second decade of the 20th century.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting.
So he's writing books, more or less interpreting history, casting a favorable light on the British Empire, despite the fact the United States supposedly earned its independence from the British Empire and fought a war with Britain in 1812 and the British that burned the White House. And of course, in America, it's full of German and Irish, immigrants, or at least, first-generation Americans who have cousins back in Ireland or back in Germany who may not be that favorable, disposed to support Great Britain. So they have to turn this mass public opinion against Germany just by creating all this propaganda. And of course, that's what the Creel Committee is all about. Edward Bernays and Walter Lippmann that's what they were doing. They're a member, this is the Eastern Seaboard Elite. The Eastern Seaboard Elite is the opinion that matters in the United States because they control the press. And they're all Anglophile.
Yeah, that's how the biographies of Charles Outchell describe him. They just say Anglophile, you know, as if that's all there is to it. He just likes England that much.
Yeah, the finance, the finances don't matter. I think it was it was Wall Street, particularly the Morgan House of Morgan, that had underwritten much of the British war effort. So one way to make sure those bonds are paid out is to drag America into the war and push the cost on the taxpayers and the hundreds of thousands of doughboys that go over there and have to fight in the trenches on behalf of the British Empire. So, but that's how empire, that's the game, the imperial game, you know. So we're up to 19. Mm-hmm. So he's a part of this Creel Committee, 1919.
So 1918, he releases German Militarism. Well, actually, the Committee on Public Information, CPI, Creel Committee, released German Militarism and Its German Critics, authored by Charles Outchell, where he was looking at, I believe, newspaper articles and different press of Germany and illustrating how it's incorrect. I guess geared, you know, mostly about the military actions going on with World War One.
Trying to paint Germany as the sort of an aggressor.
But
a
threat. Yeah, then I found. Yeah. Then I found the where he received a grant. He was granted a license by the War Trade Board to with the Trading with the Enemy Act to transmit the sum of $1,000 to Otto Feuerth. I couldn't figure out who that was, but figured it was worth including. It shows that he's at least given, you know, it could be some kind of espionage. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But thought that was pretty interesting. But yeah, that's all I've got on Charles Outchell. Then we get to his son, Frank Outchell, if you're ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So yeah, Frank Outchell was an investment banker, senior partner at Lazard Frères and Company until 1945, chairman of General Investors Corporation. His sister, Edith, became the wife of Herbert H. Lehman, the late United States Senator and Governor of New York. And Frank Outchell's wife was Miss Lehman's niece, the former Helen Lehman Goodhart. So the Outchells are married twice into the Lehman family of Lehman Brothers. And okay, so Frank Outchell, he went to Yale. He joined Lazard Frères shortly after leaving Yale. He's one of the few Americans to receive the French Foreign Legion honor because he helped stabilize the French franc in 1924. And during the 30s, he served on the governing committee to the New York Stock Exchange and as director of Rockefeller-controlled Chase National Bank. And in 1943, he became Lazard Frères' senior partner, replacing his father, Charles, upon his retirement. So that pretty much sums up his work in banking and finance. And then the story just goes on and on about propaganda. And he was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the founding members in 1920. He was council director from 34 to 72. He also had the positions of secretary and vice president from 1951 to 71. And he also chaired the finance committee in the 70s, which was in charge of fundraising for the CFR.
Hmm. So he's involved in some of the currency negotiations of the 1920s that involved, British pound, the U.S. dollar. This is the, I believe, the Genoa Conference, which props up the British pound at the expense of the U.S. dollar, which sparks a lot of the speculative stock market here in the United States and also the property boom, but creates the bubble that inevitably pops and leads to the Great Depression. And he's involved in negotiating the French franc against the pound and the dollar. And for that, he's given an award. That's interesting. You also, I see that he is a director of the Woodrow Wilson Foundation and executive committee of the American Jewish Committee. Too?
Yes. Yep.
And which would play a big role in post-war America in shaping the culture. That's interesting. So here we have this bridging of high finance and culture creation or manipulation. And with the Council on Foreign Relations. So that's sort of the whole post-war Anglo-American Zio Empire thing you see taking form there.
Yeah, I actually found a document from the AJC called Assessing Techniques for Change, Mass Media, Group Process, and Intergroup Contact, where they really lay out how they plan to use all mass media at their disposal to change people's opinions. I have a
this is part of the authoritarian.
I'd like to read from it. No, this is a separate document from 1953.
Okay.
So when I think 53, you know, yes. I think mind control,
MK Ultra, and Disney.
Exactly. So okay. Yeah, December 30th, 1953, they released the American Jewish Committee Department of Scientific Research Assessing Techniques for Change, Mass Media, Group Process, and Intergroup Contact. That's the title. It was written by Mark Vosk. So here's the introduction. Let me read this. The basic question which we are all concerned is that of change. Change in opinion, in attitude, in individual behavior, in group behavior. There is thus, to my mind at least, one essential difference between our problem and those which usually confront the educator or teacher. Ours is the task of persuasion, of changing or overlaying, so to speak, a previously structured pattern of response. Those whom we wish to persuade do not come to us to learn. They have no wish to acquire new skills or new knowledge, and certainly evidence no desire to change their attitudes. In most cases, they do not come to us at all. It is we who must approach them, establish communication with them through mass media or other means at our disposal.
Yes, that's very interesting.
So, the constituency of the American Jewish Committee, I imagine, has pretty good access to such mass media. You know, it is at their disposal.
So, well, as we can see with what Hollywood produces, yes.
Yeah.
And with standard fare and network television entertainment, yeah. It's interesting because the American Jewish Committee also published The Authoritarian Personality in 1950-51. And that pretty much laid out a plan to...
You and Joe will have done...
And a big thing on that is promoting...
Good work on that.
Is promoting Eros.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, sexualizing the culture by... You weaponize sexuality to weaken family structure, particularly the patriarchal... authority, father figure, because that was the source of the authoritarian fascist threat in the United States. Although this tendency among the Jewish elite to do this actually predates the Second World War and the Holocaust. So what we see after that is sort of an unfolding of this plan, both in entertainment, you know, in media, the cultural upheavals of the 1960s, the creation of the counterculture, which can be traced back to the CIA and MKUltra, and also the American Jewish Committee working in tandem to promote the drug culture, to promote sex, because as Herbert Marcuse who says, you know, by promoting Eros and civilization, he's one that comes up with the idea of free love and these ideas. And if you weaponize people's, if you weaponize sexuality, that's one way you undermine parental, particularly patriarchal authority, and weaken the family. And from the rationality, authority, and personality, you decrease the threat of fascism. However, how perverse that may sound to our ears, that appears to be their plan, and it appeared to have been implemented throughout the in the ensuing decades.
Yeah, they're hitting us hard with the anti-fascist message right now, yeah. Aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, that seems to be a major talking point in the media right now.
But that's, yeah, they look at, that's interesting that they would look at mass media, because you're probably familiar with Jan Evans' research regarding the radio, the Princeton Radio Research Project, and
yes,
the Halloween Eve broadcast of War of the Worlds in 1938 on the eve of the Second World War, and it was done as a test to see how people would react, and also how people would react to the interpretation of the reaction. the idea of using mass media to manipulate the public to create fear. If you're familiar with Christopher Simpson's book, The Science of Coercion, he talks about the whole study of mass communication in the run-up to the Second World War, throughout the Second World War, and in the immediate post-Cold War era, roughly 1950-1960, was all funded by the Defense Department and the CIA for the purposes of weaponizing it. You know, so that's how, when we take in media, whether we're watching television or listening to the radio or just music, mass communication, mass media, we have to understand it's as Joe Atwell says, it's not a cesspool, it's a weapon. It's been studied and created to be that very thing.
Very much, yeah. You can tell it's done with scientific precision.
Well, that document shows it. So.
Yeah, so, Frank Alchel, he was a member of the executive committee from 41 to 62 of the American Jewish Committee, and his son, Arthur Alchel, was a member from 54 to 61. Just want to get that out there. But I have some information about Amram Duchovny. He's not a member of the Alchel or Lehman family, but I came across him looking at AJC, and I thought there were some parallels here.
Mm-hmm.
He worked in public relations for the American Jewish Committee in New York, and he was also he worked for the Combined Jewish Philanthropies of Boston. He wrote 10 nonfiction books and a play, The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, that was brought into Broadway in 1967 and adapted for television. So he wrote a play, and they made a made-for-TV movie about a fictional trial for Lee Harvey Oswald. And this Amram Duchovny, who did all that, is, as you could imagine, David Duchovny's father.
I was about to ask you that.
Yeah, so when I think of David Duchovny, I think of X-Files, and when I think of X-Files, I think of The Lone Gunman.
Mm-hmm.
So, I imagine most of your listeners are familiar with the Lone Gunman pilot episode being mm-hmm. major, probably the strongest predictive programming example in film for 9/11. But I also it was put out by Fox, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch from the CFR. He's a CFR member, and you know he's reportedly close friends with Arnon Milchin, mm-hmm. the Mossad agent. Also reportedly best friends of. I'm not exaggerating there. Everything I read says best friends of. President Shimon Peres of Israel, and he just happens to be an arms procurer for Israel, and a Mossad agent. And he, Rupert Murdoch owns 20% of Arnon Milchin's company, New Regency, since 1997. And Fox owns the distributing rights until 2022 for all New Regency, which is Arnon Milchin's film company, which put out JFK. Mm-hmm. So there's another JFK connection. You know, we just got done talking about the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, and I don't know. It kind of spins off there, but that all came because of Amram Duchovny's connections to American Jewish Committee being public relations. And I think we both know public relations is a synonym for propaganda. So
he also, I think Arnon Milchin also produced a movie way back in the late 70s called The Medusa Touch.
I'm not familiar with that one.
It involves a man who has psychic powers. I think Richard Burton played it, and he's in a coma. He's in within this coma. He's carrying out acts of violence, and of course, one of the things he does from his that's later in the movie. I think earlier in the movie, he's standing at a window, an apartment, a high-rise apartment window, overlooking the city. I think it's in London. And through his powers, mental powers, he directs an airplane to crash into a building.
Yes, I saw I saw that clip. That was extremely intense. I didn't see the whole movie, just maybe that 5-minute segment. And wow, yeah, that was something.
So that's an Arnold production.
He also did Fight Club and Brazil, which have major terrorism components to the story.
That's right, because Fight Club at the end has that scene with the vertical collapse, right?
Yeah. And I love Brazil for it's just explosions and terrorism everywhere, and the people, you know, they don't even seem to flinch to it. That movie is really surreal. Mm-hmm. But I think it speaks a lot.
And because you mentioned his fact that, you know, he's an arms dealer, illegal arms dealer. But the
I was reading nuclear.
Yeah. And he got a medal. which is interesting because some people have speculated that played a role in JFK's murder.
Mm-hmm.
And Arnon Milchin's JFK is sort of a limited hangout that covers up the a lot of elements of the Kennedy assassination. One is the Israeli component, which people have written about, have speculated. Well, not speculated, they've done research, and they found the connections, through Clay Shaw and the trademark, which is owned by an Israeli banker, Tibor Rosenbaum, I think was his name, owned by the Swiss bank, and it was involved in Kennedy was going after the American Zionist Council, and also had reportedly had tried to stop Israel's nuclear program. So that's what some people think. There's one more layer to the onion that we call the JFK assassination. But that's interesting. So
well, I was going to go to the National Committee for a Free Europe, but I think I'll point out how Herbert H. Lehman sent a letter to the president in 1951 requesting that Frank Alchel be given a job in the government. He says, "My dear Mr. President, I recall that you have frequently stated that you are on the lookout for additional top-notch men to whom responsible work in government can be assigned. Accordingly, I wish to bring to your attention the name of Mr. Frank Alchel. He's an active officer in the National Committee for a Free Europe, secretary and director of the Council on Foreign Relations." Okay, so we've gone into that already. Mm-hmm. "May I emphasize that Frank is not looking for a job. He is financially independent." he's just really, really wants to help out, it looks like.
Just a patriotic American, yeah.
Yeah, he would, however, welcome a chance of serving his government, provided he could be really useful. So he got a letter back saying from the deputy undersecretary of the Secretary of State, pretty much saying he's trying to line some things up for him. And that's in April 23rd, 1951. And and we'll see that, yeah, he did do a lot of work with them. One of those, the National Committee for a Free Europe, which you probably know better, but it seems to me like was a major factor in getting the Cold War started.
Mm-hmm. That's 51, that would have been Harry Truman. And Harry Truman was the president that recognized Israel, much to the consternation of many of his advisors. You mentioned, yeah, the committee, Free Europe Committee, you have here, it's founded by Alan Dulles, created by the CIA. Dwight D. Eisenhower is a member, Lucius Clay, Cecil B. DeMille, that's interesting. movie director.
Yeah.
And of course, Henry Luce of the Time Life Empire. So here we have intelligence, military, and media converging here. It's all about perception management.
Exactly.
And C.D. Jackson, he was a Time Life guy, CIA guy, who played a part in covering up the JFK assassination, and also was involved in psychological warfare at the end of World War II. He created the fake films of the concentration camps that we now know are fake.
Wow.
Who are the names you have here?
It was founded by Alan Dulles, and it was fully created and sponsored by the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Now, did it present itself as an independent agency? Is this like a cult Congress or cultural freedom program here, or do you know?
I'm not sure.
I mean, if you have people like Lucius Clay and Eisenhower being a member, it seems pretty obvious, because they're, you know, obviously general, future president. Lucius Clay was head of he was a general and occupying force there in Europe. But Cecil B. DeMille and Henry Luce are particularly interesting, because that shows how the crossover, sort of this intersection, you know, between government and non-government, which is the media and entertainment, and, you know, and that's how most people perceive these events, is through the movies and, you know, through the newsreels, but particularly through the movies, you know,
mm-hmm.
and through like Life magazine, and just with the pictures, people are so, you know, people tend to be visually oriented, and Life magazine plays such a large role in the 20s. I think you have a part in describing the importance of Life magazine in the posting.
Yeah.
You know, just how important it was just to shaping people's idea of the world, particularly Americana, what it meant to be an American in the mid 20th century. You know, so.
Yeah, there wasn't much entertainment out there, and you know, I think radio, you know, was a big source of information and entertainment back then. We're talking 1949, early 50s.
Oh yeah,
back when National Committee for a Free Europe started the Radio Free Europe, mm-hmm. Anti-communist propaganda broadcast service.
And there's a program here in the States, because this is late 40s. Early 50s, during the founding of Israel, the Israeli state, it was very controversial, of course, as we all know, still is. Critics on the radio, if they were critical of the Israeli state, soon found themselves without employment. This was called Dynamic Silence, and this was executed by the American Jewish Committee. Pretty much what they would do, they wouldn't directly go after people, but they'd go after the sponsors of their radio shows or of their newspapers. And there were, you know, there were syndicated columnists and radio personalities who just lost their jobs because they were critical of that policy. It's called Dynamic Silence. So that's interesting. So
yeah.
Again, this is how you control the debate on a given issue. You know. Shut down alternative views. That's one way to do it, I guess, to win an mm-hmm. argument. So you also mentioned Radio Free Europe here, which is huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it seems like Frank Outchell had a major role in it. He told his sister, or sorry, his wife's sister-in-law, Cecily Goodhart, in a letter in 1950 about his experience. He was chairman and head of Radio Free Europe Radio Transmissions. He said to her that he's working from morning until night at Radio Free Europe, so which is supposed to be a propagandist weapon in the Cold War, supplementing the voice of America in a field in which the voice must be restrained because it is an agency of the government. I forgot to say the quote in there, but that would be the end quote. That's Frank Outchell's own description of what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Propaganda. So, yeah, and I found where he was being requested to smuggle radios to farmers and peasants in a letter. That was pretty interesting.
And, yeah, you have here this the serious relationship with the radio stations began to break down in 1967. When Ramparts magazine published an expose claiming that the CIA was channeling funds to civilian organizations. That's all part of the Congress of Culture and Freedom that Francis Stoner Saunders writes about. I think that Ramparts was also the magazine that exposed Gloria Steinem as a CIA asset.
All, yes, yeah. Exactly.
And again, that's all part of this controlling the left, make it, you know, this broad cultural program. And within that, you had a lot of promotion of things like modern art. Jackson Pollock was a recipient of CIA funds promoted by them. Feminist movement, these things. But also, at the time, it was justified. They said they wanted to, counter Soviet or Russian art. And the notion, I think it was the attitude, was that the Soviets had mobilized their intellectuals in this, you know, struggle for the world. And we had to mobilize our own intellectuals. Of course, if you do that, you're being just a totalitarian. But in the final analysis, I think you probably agree that that whole Cold War conflict, or call it a conflict, but the whole Cold War was a more or less a strategy of tension writ large, because at the meta level, it was being managed.
Yeah, yeah. Theater. Yeah, definitely.
It was theater, yeah. So, okay. So,
I've got a parallel I wanna draw here.
Okay.
Someone else I found with major propaganda radio experience was Richard Warren, and once again, this guy's not connected to the Lehman or Outchell family. Richard Warren, Dick Carlson. He's the father of Tucker Carlson. So he was director of the Voice of America during the last 6 years of the Cold War, which Voice of America is very similar to Radio Free Europe, totally United States, you know, government propaganda. At the same time, he led Radio Marti broadcasting to Cuba, which was a radio station in Miami that, was paid for by the government to broadcast propaganda to Cuba. He was director of the U.S. Information Agency, WorldNet, USIA Documentary Film Service. In 1991 to 1992, he was president and CEO of Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the parent company of PBS and NPR. 97, he became CEO of King World Television, who puts out Oprah, Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy. 2 years later, he sold it to CBS for $2.5 billion. Carlson was full-time vice chairman for the Foundation of the Defense of Democracies, the Counterterrorism Institute in Washington, D.C. He wrote for the Pittsburgh Tribune, a couple other papers. He was a documentary filmmaker, a bunch of stuff, but
that's a Richard Scaife newspaper, I think, right? Richard Mellon Scaife newspaper.
I'm not sure.
This is Carlson. So this is the father of Tucker Carlson.
Exactly.
A billionaire.
Yep.
So Tucker Carlson isn't self-made.
Imagine that.
You know, work his way up from the mailroom over there. Yeah. So he's probably sitting on a huge, trust fund or something. So.
Yeah, and I want to real quickly thank John Adams. He hit me to that nugget there.
Yeah, he does. He's great on these this lineage or bloodline, because
yep.
these people. So Foundation for the Defense, that's like just a neocon outfit, you know, designed to justify all the interventionism, the wars, you know, fighting terrorism. Terrorism again is a fake, you know, obviously it's, you know, it's managed, stage managed, like in Brazil.
Almost, of course. Yeah, exactly.
It's like in the movie Brazil, you know, these, and sometimes you have some real events. Sometimes you have some fake events, I think. That, you know, so either way, it's never presented to us in the media. Anyone just a little bit of research on ISIS and its origins and who's supporting it. You know, we're running all these contradictions: why NATO and Saudi Arabia and Israel are supporting ISIS and Turkey, which is a NATO country, then we're supposed to be fearing an ISIS invasion of Europe or carrying out attacks in Europe or the United States when they're getting support of the United States in the Middle East, like in countries like in Syria and Iraq. You know, so.
Yeah.
So, but that, you know, yeah, that you got to look at these connections. You're right. Again, what's being spelled out here is that the institutions and the individuals that rely on for the news, their interpretation of the news, you know, they're all connected, you know, either financially or through bloodlines, and they all have a very narrow interest of a small group that are presenting the news to us.
Yeah, like even the list of people I started off with, you know, I would have never assumed how closely they were connected. You know, there were a lot of last names there.
Yeah,
that I would have never thought Lehman or Alchol, but. When you see the family tree and you just see that, okay, all these banking families and, you know, these, what you call elite or oligarchs, yeah, they just intermarry. And I actually, if you look at the family tree that I included, you know, from their directory, there's a branch that twists, which isn't normal for a family tree to have a twist in between two branches.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's there's some inbreeding there too.
That happens eventually. They got to bring new blood in, and then, you know, I think some say that's what Diana was all about in the royal family. And they get rid of her. I mean, it's like the social registry, right? Who's who in America and social registry, and, you know, these things serve. It's not just an opportunity to be snobby or snooty. It serves a practical function. No.
Mm-hmm.
There's no stronger alliance than marrying into a family, right? Although even within these families, there is a often much acrimony and infighting. I did a show recently regarding the Kushner family and what Jared Kushner's father was involved in. He set up his brother-in-law with a prostitute. So,
wow.
Money doesn't always buy happiness.
Yeah, I'd like to give it a shot sometime.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, all things being equal, yeah, perhaps. But all things are never equal, right? So,
right.
Yes. Okay. So that's it. So, the Committee on Present Danger. Yeah, so he's the founder of the Committee on Present Danger. Because that's there just to promote the Cold War, right?
Yeah. That's
all the fun. All the spending and. Justifying the illegal Korean War and these things, right?
Exactly. Yeah, and a lot of big names tied up in that.
But yeah, Paul Nitze, Vannevar Bush, Wild Bill Donovan, yeah, James Conant, Harvard president. I mean, so this is pretty much, you know, this is, you know, the establishment here.
Yeah, and according to Wikipedia, in 1951. The Committee on the Present Danger launched a 3-month scare campaign over the NBC network Every Sunday night thereafter, the group used the mutual broadcasting system to talk to the nation about the present danger and the need to take action. Which, of course, action was eventually taken. Once they controlled the... That was 1951.
It says during the Korean War.
Yep.
Yeah, this is right after the North Korea supposedly invaded South Korea after the U.S. Secretary of State said Korea was outside our defense perimeter. And then, all of a sudden, we got to go in under the auspices of the UN.
Yeah. The world, that's how you get peace.
Yeah. Yeah. So, a 3-month scare campaign. Were they public service announcements?
I think they were using magazine, news magazine, like the TV show kind of pieces to push it.
Yeah, this is the early stage of the Cold War when there was some resistance, particularly in the Republican Party, the old right. And this is during that purge. People like William F. Buckley played a big part in this, in purging non-interventionist or isolationist. I don't like that word. It's more non-interventionist elements out of the Republican Party, out of the old right. People like Robert Taft was denied the nomination in 1952. Gets given to Eisenhower. But to kind of purge that element out of the Republican Party to create what was called the Cold War consensus. And CIA hands, like, good example, another figure is William F. Buckley, right? CIA. Starts National Review, which has obvious links to the CIA and funding, which is has very murky finances. But this would manage the right in the Cold War, in the dialectic, the dialectic of American politics, the right-left thing. But he'd manage the right, get him aboard the Cold War agenda. Because at the time, the Cold War agenda was a democratic thing. It was Truman that started it. But in that piece, you talk Committee on Present Danger. Committee on Present Danger was very influential because it was Paul Nitze who wrote much of NSC 68, National Security Council Memorandum 68, which kind of set the contours for the Cold War, U.S. policy, and also economic policy, because it was that document, I think, that foresaw militarism as an essential part of economic planning in the United States. And John Adams has done a lot about how the whole defense industry had shaped entire, cultures, our entire culture, particularly Southern California, with the defense industry and the aeronautical industry, and not to mention the interstate highway system in suburbia, which was all part of this planning. Very interesting.
Yep.
So here, yeah, the Cold War. So this Committee on Present Danger justifies the Cold War interventionist policies, which becomes pretty much, this normal policy for the United States after the Second World War, and into the late 20th century, and obviously as we see now into the 21st century, where it just becomes standard policy for the U.S. to intervene in other countries, occasionally bomb them, and occupy them, and all this, obviously not for the. For the American people, but for the oligarchs who control the the finances and the defense spending that enriches their corporations and leaves Americans holding the bill, and also the immense debt burden that all these things create.
Yep.
But you have here a connection with Gordon Wasson and Frank Ulcher, which is interesting.
Yeah, Jan Ervin's done a lot of exposing the connections there. I imagine, most of the audience is familiar with who our Gordon Wasson was, vice president of public relations at J.P. Morgan. And he, in 1957, released a book called Mushrooms, Russia, and History, which was actually printed and published by Frank Alchel's printing company called Overbrook Press, which he ran out of an old hog shed, converted hog shed. And I imagine that might just be a nice little story to tell. They probably tore down the hog shed and you know, put up a building there. But yeah, he printed one of Gordon Wasson's books and provided a printing plate for it called Napoleonic Caricature, which presents a couple really demonic looking creatures chopping down a mushroom. I can't really understand the symbolism, but it's pretty demonic looking. And yeah, that just happened to be, you know, I didn't read the book. I found the document and I read the couple paragraphs around the caricature there that Frank Altschul is given the credit for giving the plate. And it was Aldous Huxley, a bunch of quotes from Aldous Huxley wrapped around the picture, which I thought were interesting. I thought that's funny. So yeah, of course, our Gordon Wasson goes on to write they have the Time Life piece about the magic mushroom, and it gets the ball rolling on the counterculture.
Mm-hmm. That's the May 1957 edition of Life magazine, the magic mushroom. And of course, that's been through various document research. It's been traced to a sub-project to MK Ultra to promote the drug culture, the counterculture. Again, what's important is you have R. Gordon Wasson being the head of public relations for J.P. Morgan, working with the CIA. Once again, we have that connection between finance and CIA. Why are they involved in culture creation or manipulation? Of course, that predates the Summer of Love by a decade. And so they're creating an environment, they're looking ahead a decade, that's going to produce the conditions that allow for the turmoil of the 1960s, which was largely stage managed. But that's interesting because you have him with R. Gordon Wasson, but you also you've drawn the connection between Frank Altschul and the previously mentioned Edward Bernays, who played a big role, of course, which most people are aware of his role in shaping our habits, our tastes, and our thoughts, as he wrote in his book Propaganda, right? We have the story. You tell the story about the green ball, which I think is everyone hears about the cigarettes. You know, the torches of liberty.
Yeah,
I wasn't familiar with the green ball thing. That was interesting.
Me neither. Yeah. I'm glad I could share that too. Because I that was the first I had heard of it. Edward Bernays in October 25th, 1934. He held an event at the Waldorf Astoria, which was, of course, a propaganda, a cultural manipulation disguised as a charity benefit. Frank Altschul's wife, Helen Lehman Goodhart Altschul, was on the infirmary board, which was receiving the money for the charity event, and she was on the board along with Bernays's wife, and Helen Lehman Goodhart and Frank Altschul also attended this event, and it was all in reality for Lucky Strike cigarettes, who were having a hard time selling their cigarettes, and studies, I guess, showed it was probably because of the green color of the package. So Bernays decided it'd be cheaper to change opinions rather than to change the packaging.
That's interesting. I think, why not change the color of the packaging? But
no, it's cheaper this way.
Cheaper, I guess. If people are that easy?
Yeah, I guess so. He went as far as getting magazines to write about how fashionable the color green is. They would do editorials on home furnishings about how that's the color green's good for that. It's having textile manufacturers make green gowns, and
I mean, this just shows you just how insidious and how, I mean, the things you wouldn't even think of, the manipulating, they're manipulating. Because all of a sudden people's fashion taste are being manipulated to boost cigarette sales. Green's more.
This is the world we live in.
Yeah, and the fact that the world is that malleable, meaning that these institutions that we think are separate, independent, you know, they're how easy they could be brought on board and manipulated, controlled from the center, if you will. And this right here should all of a sudden now magazines have nothing to do with cigarettes are promoting green in homes, all so that you can boost the sale of cigarettes.
You know, yeah,
and give women lung cancer. I don't know, but I mean, it's, using green paper, he concocted a letter writing campaign to interior decorators, art industry groups, department stores, and club women, describing the sudden dominance of green. Now, again, clubs that you think are independent are being manipulated by this man for the who's an agent of these corporations. And
yep.
If you just, you know. What do you infer from that? What's the conclusion you draw from that? Or just project that onto other areas, like public policy or something, if you want to promote a war. I don't know. You start, sell G.I. Joe dolls. Our, you
know? Well, I even see, like, the cartoons the kids watch.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like the characters and their vehicles and stuff are designed to be toys. And actually, the toy manufacturers own the shows, so they design the toys first. And the way that the camera highlights, the direction of the show, really, if you look at it that in a certain light, you can see that it's the whole thing is an advertisement for the car and the accessories and everything. It's I just think, we're being manipulated for all reasons, financial and political.
And he said, with Bernays, he persuaded the Reinhardt Gallery to hold a green exhibition of paintings. The result was a six-month flurry of green became the hot new color of fashion. So a whole fashion trend, which, it's very debatable how fashion trends begin, or how hairstyles begin. It's all that's managed too, but gives us an example of how it's done and why it's done. Whether increasing the sale of cigarettes, your toys and these things are there to shows and now promote the toys. Yeah, it used to be that you'd have a popular show and the toy would be produced. Because the show is popular. Now the toy there is there to produce the show. But with Bernays on Frank Altschul, you mentioned, of course, into sort of geopolitics, because they play a big role in the 1954 Guatemala coup that was engineered by the CIA that deposed the regime of Jacobo Arbenz, because he had run afoul of the United Fruit Company.
Yep.
Of course, he's involved in Bernays in promoting Castillo Armas as the new leader of Guatemala. They paint Jacobo Arbenz red because he's instituting some land reform. He's seizing the property of United Fruit Company, but really he's just it's compensated. no different than the United States government does from time to time. They institute this coup, then subject the country to some. Better part of 40 years of civil war that kills hundreds of thousands of people. But the role that Bernays plays is very important in justifying this to the American people to the extent that they even know about it. And he was paid $100,000 from the United Fruit Company for his efforts. And at the same time, the CIA, Alan Dulles and his brother, John Foster Dulles, are board members or representing United Fruit Company at the law firm.
As well as Robert Lehman, mm-hmm. who served on the UFC board.
So
Frank Altschul authored a public report in 1953 by the Committee on International Policy of the National Planning Association that seemed to kind of get the ball rolling with the takeover over there. It was signed by 22 committee members of the CFR.
There, Chris, the law firm Sullivan Cromwell represented all these corporations. But here you have the established United Fruit Company to put a positive spin on the banana-growing countries themselves. This person created a front group called the American Middle Information Bureau. This is another AstroTurf operation being conducted to inform journalists and academics on what's going on in the country. $100K, man, for his efforts. And this is similar to what occurred in Iran, too, the year before.
The coup
through Mossadegh for the benefit of the Seven Sisters.
Yeah, they were busy those couple years. It seemed like it was all for financial gain for corporations.
That's the plan, is they have to to gain access to resources on the cheap in some of these countries, so they have to destabilize the countries, and they do it in the name of national security, fighting communism, so they wrap their efforts in the flag. It's just a way to sort of socialize their risks and their expenses, and at the same time privatizing their profits, and that's, of course, the name of the game. That's how you become an oligarch. But you also talk about the connection of Frank Altschul and the, to MK Ultra through marriage, because this woman, Siri von Ries, is married to Altschul Sr.
Right.
And she's apparently involved in some of these conferences about the psychotropic drugs or psychedelic drugs.
Yeah. So Arthur Altschul Sr. is the son of Frank Altschul. And yeah, he married one of his wives, was Siri von Ries Altschul. And yeah, she took part in the anthropopharmacological search for psychoactive drugs, which was a convention put on by the National Institute of Mental Health, Public Health Services, U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she worked alongside Richard Evan Schultes, who's everything I've read and watched about him, he's kind of described as an Indiana Jones type character. They've got all these films of him traveling the Amazon alone and nearly dying, searching out all these natural drugs or whatever. So they worked in tandem at the Harvard. I don't remember what it was called, but yeah, the institute that Harvard had,
Harvard
that was
Botanical Museum.
There we go.
Yeah,
that's it.
I'm staring at the paragraph. So there.
So yeah, Siri von Ries, she did a lot of work on the substance called Vilca. Which is like a snuff from the Amazon, I guess, that is a vehicle for DMT,
mm-hmm.
which I didn't even know they were talking about DMT in 1967 when this event took place. But yeah, she's written a lot of books on Vilca. Also known as Anandenanthera, which she actually changed some of the science behind the way they classify the plant Anandenanthera. But yeah, so with this anthropopharmacological search for psychoactive drugs, it's quite a mouthful. EPSD, we'll call it from now on. It had a lot of MK Ultra connections.
Yeah, this
the head
is
of
Yeah, this is the peak of MK Ultra when they're flooding the country with LSD.
Yeah, and
heroin from Vietnam.
they were blatant enough to, you know, put the a government name behind what they were doing here. So I guess they weren't too worried yet of being exposed of what they were up to.
Yeah, this follows the Huxley plan. So this the, you know, the drugging of America, or, you know, you have here, yeah, I mentioned just the flooding of the mass distribution of LSD, by the CIA, through these various rock festivals. This, of course, this is important, the development of the counterculture being utilized for this, because the rock felt these Dionysian rock festivals played a big part in that. The Grateful Dead, as both Joe Atwell and John Irvin have written about, how they were more or less an intelligence operation to promote the use of LSD at their rock concerts. They were funded by Peggy Mellon Hitchcock and from the banking family, and that also links them to Timothy Leary. He was also the recipient of this supposed counterculture guy who was the CIA asset as well. So there you go. And ties into MK Ultra, you know. And Timothy Leary was also, I think, friends with Mary Meyer, who reportedly had an affair with President Kennedy, and some say had introduced him to LSD. And the funny thing about that is one of the programs of LSD was to drug political leaders. So
yeah,
you hear the story about Mary Meyer and you kind of wonder what her role, was she manipulated or something? Of course, she ended up dead the following fall, killed along the canal. Still an unsolved murder, because apparently she knew something about the Kennedy assassination that the powers that be didn't want the public to know, or reportedly she was threatening to talk about it. But of course, she was the ex-wife of Kordmeyer, right?
That's all new to me. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Kordmeyer was CIA, and so, and could be yet another motive for the Kennedy assassination. You're screwing my wife, albeit my ex-wife. But come on. But anyway, so that's, I mean, that's, again, we were talking about her, this guy's wife. She's involved in these symposiums and conferences, which were all being conducted at the time, about the use of hallucinogenic drugs, mass dosing of society, and it's being carried out, it's being tested through the use of popular culture, because these rock festivals, the music is promoting the use of LSD. And of course, with the research of people like Dave McGowan and Jan Irvin, we know that these groups, whether it's the Grateful Dead or the groups in the Lower Canyon scene, are there as sort of to play the role of Pied Pipers. Not only to introduce drugs to the youth of America, but also to sort of blunt or defang any meaningful opposition to the Vietnam War or to the establishment, because at the same time you're creating the counterculture, you're creating the reaction to the counterculture, which is Nixon's silent majority, you know. So society's being manipulated on both ends here. But one interesting part is you bring up, of course, the role of Patricia Altschul, who is a sort of a socialite. She gets involved in a lot of, apparently, some, I guess, you would think would be benign programming, right? Like on the Bravo network?
Yeah, I imagine, yeah, probably a lot of housewives see it as that.
Mm-hmm. But
I'm sorry.
Yeah, John Adams has done a lot of research about, you know, just cooking shows being related to the CIA. Of course, you know, what's her name? You know, the French cook.
Oh.
You know, not my name fails me now. She was OSS.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the movie with Meryl Streep. Name fails me now. He did.
Fairchild.
Not right? Fairchild. No, it's. That's annoying. You know, heavy set girl. OSS.
Oh, okay.
At a talk, yeah. Cooking show.
Yeah, the southern one.
She did French cooking.
Oh,
back in the 70s.
Yeah, I thought I thought I named her.
And it was part of a. Look it up here. But it was he says it's sort of introducing America to European cooking was a part of the agenda of keeping America acclimating Americans to be completely involved in Europe. And this was, of course, that was sort of NATO's agenda. Because America's role in NATO was supposed to be temporary at the start. But he also, you know, he's also done things like on tiki culture.
Yep.
Which acclimating America towards being having a role or a place in the Pacific Ocean. It's all about the cultural conditioning for empire. And this is why I thought this Patricia Altschul is interesting, because she's involved in sort of a TV show, broadcasting program, TV program that's big in promoting certain types of consumerism. And, of course, that takes me back to that whole green ball thing with Bernays. You know, how you can get people to follow a certain pattern of consumption just through TV programming. Which I think is fairly obvious. It's why you have commercials.
Yeah.
But people still don't think they're being programmed. But what's interesting is the daughter. Is it Serena who gets involved in MTV?
Yep. She's the daughter of Siri Von Rees and Arthur Altschul Sr. Yeah, she started at Channel One News in the 90s. And Channel One News is broadcast into public schools. Public schools get they sign a contract to get to rent out TVs. They get allowed use of televisions and audio video equipment. For the price of subjecting their students to 12 minutes a day of their program, which is supposed to be a news program, but from the studies I read, there's not a whole lot of news going on. It seems like a lot of advertising and some liberal propaganda thrown in, and a lot of sports and consumerism.
And that's also where, what's his name, CNN?
Yep. Anderson Cooper, mm-hmm. as well as Lisa and Laura Ling. Mm. They all got their start there.
And of course, they're later involved in that thing in North Korea, right? With their Clinton saves them or something?
Yeah, where they were crossing the border, pretending to be filming something else, but they were actually trying to shoot the nuclear facilities, I think the story goes.
Mm-hmm.
They got arrested, but somehow the cameraman Mitch Koss escaped, and he seemed to have been following them around every job they worked at, really, from Channel One to MTV when Serena was there doing True Life and all those shows, all the way up until Laura Ling and Lisa Ling were working for Al Gore at Current, the Current network.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me think maybe he's some kind of handler or something. I don't have any evidence, but yeah, it's I find that guy following them around to all these different positions and sneaking away when they all got arrested. Kind of interesting.
But here we have Serena Altschul. She's a scion of a very wealthy banking family, getting a position within the media. Again, another example of a self-made self-made person. Again, trust fund probably, but she's getting these jobs. She's at MTV. Of course, the culture programming that's going on MTV is fairly obvious. It's about
the program that seemed to be her baby was called True Life, and I remember watching it as a young man, and it was mostly like exposés, documentary style, where they were following drug addicts, think that's all. That's all I really remember. They talk about the meth epidemic. It's like I even remember wondering at the time how much of this is true. Is there an epidemic, or are they creating one by
talking,
by telling
about, yeah.
yeah telling the youth all about this stuff?
It's like the news reports on crack. It's powerful, it's strong, and it's cheap.
Exactly.
It's like a commercial for the product. Yeah. Then that's part of that cultural conditioning or programming. And of course, it's true life. True life is always, you know, some sort of deviant lifestyle, or you know, there's no normal because they're too boring. You know, this guy goes to a job in the morning, kisses his wife, comes home, and plays with his kids, and you know, who wants to see that? No, you want to see the true life. That's like real world, right?
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
This is the real world. You live in a house for a year for free, and you live with people you have nothing in common with. That's not the real world, you know. But that's what they want, because that's how you create this atomized situation where you don't live in any, you don't have any family, you have no tradition, everything was mixed together. You know, you create this atomized society. And of course, that began the trend of what reality TV, which is again completely fake. So there you go. We have these people again, these scions of wealth, being given these perched on these positions in the media to shape our culture, to influence us, and we're never really given their background, and there's a reason for this. But one thing this leads us to, what you lead us to, is this odd story about John Miller, right? He marries into the Altschul family, right?
Yes, he married Emily Altschul, who is Serena Altschul's sister.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I guess we're getting back to the Osama bin Laden interview. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this guy.
Oh, Julia Child. Julia Childs.
Yeah, see, I said Fairchild.
Fairchild.
Yeah,
I should have gotten that when you said Fairchild. I was thinking Morgan Fairchild when you said that. Julia Childs. Right. Yeah, sorry. I just, you know, when you forget an obvious name and it comes back to your mind, you just want to say it.
Yeah.
But go ahead. John Miller.
Yeah, he's actually the godson of Luciano crime family boss Frank Costello's wife, which
okay,
and he did a lot of reporting on John Gotti. That's how he kind of got his start in reporting, or one of his big first scoops. I went through his LinkedIn page, and he got his start 1973 to 85 at WNEW TV. News Channel 5 in New York, 85 to 93, reporter for WNBC TV, as well as NBC News, the national version, 94 to 95. Now he's become deputy commissioner / chief spokesman at NYPD. And he was appointed by William Bratton, who later became vice chairman of the Homeland Security Advisory Council under Obama.
So now we have organized crime linking with entertainment, linking with media, and high finance.
Well, yeah, here I've got another one for you along those lines with Bill Bratton. Bill Bratton was chairman at Kroll Private Security.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And yeah, so Kroll Private Security was owned by Jules B. Kroll, who is the father of Nick Kroll. Nick Kroll is known for The Kroll Show on the Comedy Central Network. He's a comedian.
Wow. Now, you mentioned he was his godson to Luciano crime family, Frank Costello, his wife?
Yep, yep. That's right there on Wikipedia, and I think even like New York Times or major mainstream.
Okay, and he's got a major role in law enforcement. Okay, that's interesting. Now, you know, it goes back from media and law enforcement. That's interesting in of itself. But this link to organized crime is particularly interesting. Now, you say he got some stories on John Gotti?
Yeah, yeah. It seemed like he was getting the scoop.
The scoop. Which is interesting because, if I'm not mistaken, Gotti was Gambino, right?
I'm not sure.
And there was wasn't there a war between Gambino and Luciano families, and which resulted in, was it Paul Castellano who was shot to death? And but anyway, I'm not sure. I'm getting into the intrigues of the New York family, the five families. But I find it interesting that Gambino, Gotti was part of Gambino, and this guy is linked to Luciano crime family. And he's being fed scoops on John Gotti, who eventually goes to jail. So, but anyway, go ahead.
For 2 years, 94 to 95, he was there at NYPD. Then in 1997, he became anchor/correspondent at ABC News. He did that until 2002. So in that time frame, 97 to 2002, a lot of major stuff happened. He sat alongside Barbara Walters, who is CFR, at ABC News 2020. He reported on Columbine. He covered September 11th attacks, sitting alongside Peter Jennings, another CFR. The whole day of 9/11, I guess, listening, as the story goes, listening to the radio and talking to FBI, and then feeding the information directly to Peter Jennings. He was like the intermediary.
Yeah.
Then he leaves 2003 to 2005. He becomes Bureau Chief of Counterterrorism and Criminal Intelligence Bureau of LAPD.
Despite being the godson to Luciano. Okay.
He was one of the original designers of the Los Angeles Joint Regional Intelligence Center. And so then he goes to the FBI and becomes assistant director from 2005 to 2009, where he did a lot of work with media relations and the news media, publicity kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
2009 to 2011, he joins the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which was formed post 9/11 to be the group that oversees the CIA and the FBI, NSA, to kind of collate the information, because, you know, as the story goes, there was a breakdown in communication. So this is supposed to be the organization to take care of that. And so he had the role of Assistant Deputy Director of Intelligence Analysis, 2009 to 2011. But then he leaves that in 2010 to 2014 to become Senior Correspondent at CBS News. So he's just bouncing back and forth, back and forth. I find it interesting that this is a really hot time once again for news stories. You know, 97 to 2002, the major stuff happened there. But 2010 to 2014, he was reporting on Sandy Hook and there's multiple mainstream articles written about how just John Miller had all the info before any of the other networks when it came to Sandy Hook. He knew who the shooter was. He knew the gun that was used. He knew that the mother was dead. I guess he had the scoop before anybody. I think we can assume why.
Mm-hmm.
How that could happen.
And of course, the reason why his name comes up is we mentioned going into this interview that he had this scoop with Osama bin Laden in 1998. And so there he is on September 11, 2001, talking about the attacks, which that afternoon would be pinned on Osama bin Laden, which would serve, a lot of people's agendas after that, because that justified the invasion of Afghanistan and eventually, oddly enough, the invasion of Iraq. So here we get, so we have all these connections. We're getting close to the end of the interview here. What should we draw? What have you drawn from all these connections? I know what I draw from it, but what do you draw from it?
Well, I would say I'm completely satisfied to say that, you know, I can assume the entire media system, news, entertainment, is all controlled, manipulated. I laugh now when I think about people that, you know, aspire to be an actor or write for the newspaper or something. It's just, you know, it seems like you've got to be connected, and yeah, that they are manipulating us from every angle, and it's the people with the money, the bankers, or at least they are tasked with the job of manipulating us.
Mm-hmm.
I find it strange that they kind of seem to hold two roles, finance, you know, the banking side and media. It's strange. I would think that those people would, you know, being in banking would be so elite that they wouldn't have to do something like that. As far as like a second job or have any kind of job. So I don't know. I guess it's really to just ensure that they stay where they are, and by keeping us controlled.
Yeah, I mean, I think Carol Quigley wrote about this in Tragedy and Hope about how the CFR does this. There's a technique mm-hmm. to it where they'll create a fake diversity of opinion that comes to the same conclusion, so you think what you're getting is the best policy because great minds are coming to the similar conclusions from different segments of society, whether it's academia, media, journalism, these things. Yet it's all coordinated through the CFR because they it's very Masonic in a way, because more the same way the intelligence agencies do it. They'll ensconce or install their agents at news bureaus and government departments and academia, and you know, this is, you know, they'll produce academic journals like Foreign Affairs, right? It's not an academic journal, it's a it's a journal of the CFR, but it, you know, they'll have scholarly journals or articles written on behalf of the CFR, the interest behind the CFR, so it appears that this really is independent opinion. It really isn't, because it's all coordinated from the center. Because they've successfully taken over, infiltrated these supposedly independent institutions, whether they're a newspaper or, or a news station or a magazine, even something like Popular Mechanics is suborned. We saw that with 9/11. We don't think of Popular Mechanics as being political or National Geographic, for that matter. Or Life Magazine, which is obvious, the Time, Life, Empire, Skull and Bones, and these things. Political journals, you know, whether it's Mother Jones or National Review or, you know, or New Republic, they're all bought out. They're all controlled by the same interests. And if you painstakingly go through and research this and make these connections, you're not just engaging wild conspiracy theory. The connections are all there. You know, it's fairly simple. I think there was Oscar Calloway, a senator in 1917, spoke from the floor of the United States Senate, how J.P. Morgan had bought up about a couple dozen newspapers to control public opinion. Because through those newspapers, and you don't have to control everyone in the newspaper, you just have to control the editor.
Yeah, what did they figure out? 20, they needed 25?
Yeah, 25 newspapers, and then every other newspaper relied on those newspapers for the news feed, and that was it.
Yep.
And that today we have, what, five or six corporations controlling 90% of the media? And they all
and they get it all from the AP.
Yeah, yeah, and they're all interlocked the same way. You have through interlocking directorates, these corporations are all the same people. They all coordinate these things. You know, it's a very you're probably talking about a few thousand people at the end of the day. And, and as you can tell, they all intermarry.
Yep.
So, you know, they all hang out together. So it's a community. It's a shared values and interests. It's a an aristocracy, so to speak. And they have the means, the motive, and the opportunity to control the agenda as you're posting shows. And what's interesting is how they'll go in and they'll manipulate things you wouldn't think were connected, you know, like fashion colors or something, just to promote cigarettes. How's that connected to cigarettes? Well, because psychology is a big part of it. You know, that's what Edward Bernays' role was in mass psychology. That's why when you quoted that piece regarding the manipulation of mass media, you know, why that was key. And that, of course, that involves Hollywood and things like that. And if you want to know about the role of Hollywood, you just read that, you know, the work of Jay Dyer. I recommend for that his book Esoteric Hollywood, because so many people now, I mean, obviously the vast majority of people's perception of reality is through the simulacrum of Hollywood through video games, and it's getting even creepier. As you know, when I was a kid, when we wanted to play ping pong, we had to play ping pong. Now I go to people's houses and kids are playing ping pong on Wii. Right?
I mean, yeah.
I'm thinking, what's happening? I mean, you know, it's and further we get, the further we get removed from reality, the more easier we're fooled. I think, you know, not to say that the World War II generation were awake, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I found your piece so interesting, because you went through these connections, just through drawing these connections. Like, there it is, you know.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm glad I got to talk to you about it. I learned a lot from you, as I always do. I feel like I always learn as much from you as from your guests. You do a great show.
Well, thank
you. So I'm honored to be on here and big fan.
Thank you. I love your website. I like the name. It's a great name. Who came up with that name?
That was Nino.
Oh, that was good. Four Horses, Asses of the Apocalypse. But yeah.
Yeah, his theory is... Well, I guess the definition of apocalypse is to bring to light or something along those lines. Mm-hmm. So he's going, I guess, with the true definition of apocalypse. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so. Yeah, it's goofy, but it's our site.
Yeah. So I want to thank you for your research. It's very useful to go through and make these connections. Just got to go through and connect the dots, so to speak. Something that apparently they weren't able to do in 9/11, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, okay, great. Now, listen, Kyle, thanks.
Yes, sir.
Is now anything, your website and any other websites you should go to? Is it just look up Four Horses, Asses of the Apocalypse?
Yeah, and I've got to plug, I guess, Hoaxbusters Call and Chris over there. I would definitely say go to his site, too.
Yeah, listen to his three-hour talks. Cover a lot. It's very different, entertaining. I love it because it's just, you know, you just play it, and you don't have to listen all at one time. I usually download it after the fact, and, people call in. They kind of just chat about different things. Sort of a kind of an intellectual free for all, speculative, and all that stuff. And so all in good fun.
Yeah,
all in good faith. So great. Okay, well, I'll let you go because you told me you wanted to end it before your wife got home. So man of my honor, I won't get you in trouble.
Thank you, sir.
Are you doing that stuff again? No. Okay, well, listen, take care. This I'll probably post in a day or two. When I do, I will send you the link so you have that.
Thank you very much.
Great. Good night, then. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.